History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. As a young man, Fyodor Dostoevsky was a celebrated writer, and he achieved a small amount of fame at the age of 25 with his first book, Poor Folk. But his involvement with the radical politics of his day that swept Europe during the revolutions of the 1840s caused him to be sent to a long exile in Siberia. There, he spent years studying the criminals that were his companions. Many of them were murderers, and he had a chance to get into their minds. Upon his return to St. Petersburg in the 1860s, he fought his way through gambling addiction and debt, along with the death of those closest to him, epilepsy, and literary banishment. This lifetime of troubles resulted in his book, Crime and Punishment, but the true inspiration came from the sensational true crime story of a notorious murderer who charmed and outraged Paris in the 1830s. This was Pierre-François Lacenaire. He was an egoist and a nihilist and justified his crimes because he thought that his victims deserved it. Dostoevsky wanted to create a Russian incarnation of Lacenaire, a character who could demonstrate the errors of radical politics and ideas. His name was Raskolnikov. Today's guest is Kevin Birmingham, author of the new book, The Sinner and the Saint, Dostoevsky and the Gentleman Murderer Who Inspired a Masterpiece. We discuss how Raskolnikov then began to merge with his creator. Dostoevsky was determined to tell a murder story from the murderer's perspective, but his character couldn't be a monster. The murderer would be chilling because he was so desperate to be good. This writing project consumed Dostoevsky, and his debts and the predatory terms of his contract caught up with him. He had to hire a stenographer, Anna Grigorievna, to finish it on time. She became Dostoevsky's first reader and chief critic and changed the way he wrote forever. By the time Dostoevsky finished his great novel, he had fallen in love. Crime and Punishment advanced a revolution in artistic thinking and began the greatest phase of Dostoevsky's career. As you can see, there's a lot of history that goes into the creation of this novel. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Kevin Birmingham. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is will be an interesting topic because I enjoy the works of Dostoevsky, and I've experienced or I've studied a good deal of 19th century Russia by proxy because my area is the Ottoman Empire, and that was always someone that the Russian Empire could beat up on when it couldn't win other wars happening. So I guess I'd like to start from the entry point is Russia at this time period itself. And I wonder what's so special about it, because it is the setting for arguably some of the most enduring classics of this time period of Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and others, of War and Peace, Anna Karenina, Brothers Karamazov, Crime and Punishment. But at the time period itself, Russia, one could say, wasn't all that special. Many people look to France for its culture, for its artistic achievements. Yeah. A theme in all these Russian books is the anxiety that people are speaking French and they're putting on this performance and denying their Russianness. And there's a bit of truth to that, that the empire is less educated than its European rivals. It's less power militarily. So what is it that's so special about Russia in the 19th century that has produced these enduring classics?
It's because, at least in part, because Russia saw itself as both European and non-European at the same time. And it saw itself as being a part of a crossroads. Europe was industrializing. They were becoming more urban. Russia was, of course, partly in Europe, but mostly in Asia. And Russians felt themselves partly European and partly non-European. And so a hovering question over most Russians was, how European should we be? Should we follow Europe's lead in industrialization? Should we be more interested in science and technology? Or is there something unique and distinctive about our tradition and our history, our Slavic roots, that we should focus on? And the debates between these two camps, what were called the Slavophiles and the Westerners, were heating up in the mid-19th century. And they started to come to a head in the wake of the 1848 revolutions that swept Europe. So, you know, as they began in Paris, but then quickly spread to almost every European capital. And suddenly, large groups of people, entire populations, were agitating for fundamental changes in the way they were governed. That included advocating for constitutions and legislative assemblies, in some cases democracies, in some cases socialist democracies. Russians looked to Europe and wondered if this should be their fate as well. That sense of insecurity and indecision was a great starting point for literature. The dual sense of Russia being both behind Europe and at the same time special and perhaps even above Europe as far as some people were concerned was this dual lens through which Russians saw themselves. And you can see it in Dostoevsky's own life. He began as someone who was very interested in adopting Western ideas. It's partly what got him arrested and imprisoned. But as time went on, he became more and more conservative, more and more interested in upholding the ideas that were underpinning the Tsarist regime.
Right. I mean, that type of conflict is a great setting. And a professor of mine who's Turkish noted the similarities with Russia and Turkey, that there are competing identities. And out of that tension, a unique identity is forged. So it makes challenges for a society. But hey, all that conflict is great for storytelling.
Right.
Getting into Dostoevsky himself, the points of his early life, his politics, what gets him arrested, his crippling addictions that cause a lot of tensions of his own. Can you speak to that in regards to what comes later and the person who inspires him to write Crime and Punishment?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, when he was young, his father wanted him to be an engineer and enrolled him in the engineering academy. So as a teenager, he was forced to imagine himself as having a lifelong career in the army. And if you wanted to get ahead in Russian society at the time, the army was the clearest way to do so. They had a massive standing army, about 800,000 soldiers, which was larger than any army in Europe. And Dostoevsky, early on, from probably about the age of 16, realized that what he wanted to do with his life was to be a writer. And he had the great fortune / misfortune of having his father die when he was 17. And so that authority figure was very quickly removed. He was an orphan at the age of 17 because his mother died when he was 15. And he saw that he had a narrow opportunity to prove himself as a writer. He renounced his estate for 1,000 silver rubles and used that money to support himself while he wrote his first novel. It's a novel that no one reads anymore. It's called Poor Folk. And it's an epistolary novel. It's a little bit melodramatic. He was celebrated as an up-and-coming novelist in St. Petersburg, even before Poor Folk was published. So at the age of 24, Dostoevsky was already achieving early fame in literary St. Petersburg. Fast forward 4 years, and before dawn one morning, he's arrested by the Tsar's secret police, and he ends up spending nearly a decade in Siberia for charges of sedition and spreading free thinking. And he effectively has to start his career all over again in 1860. So he had a roller coaster of a career before he even started to write virtually all of the novels and stories that we still read today.
It also sounds, too, that the people in his book, especially the wealthy upper crust, along with characters in Tolstoy's books, enjoy obscene levels of luxury, but are also in terrible, crippling debt.
Yeah.
So what we're facing in America now in the 21st century isn't new. We see this in other societies. 19th century Russia is one of them. The struggles that he has, I mean, they sound like they're what he sees.
Could be out of a novel.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, how chaotic was his life? Was it completely just total chaos?
I mean, he was not very good with money, which is a problem. Look, if you want to be a writer in 19th century Russia, we're talking about a society in which only a small fraction of the population is literate. What that means is that the book buying public is very small. And if you're going to make ends meet and pay your bills, just being a writer, it's going to be very, very difficult. Most of the writers that we recall today from the same time period, people like Tolstoy or Turgenev, they were wealthy. They were independently wealthy. They came from families that had hundreds of serfs, and they didn't need to publish fiction in order to make ends meet. Dostoevsky was not of that same class. He did not have a large store of wealth to rely upon. And he quickly realized how difficult it was to make a living from literature. What made it even worse was that after Dostoevsky came back from Siberia, he eventually developed an addiction to gambling. when he first entered a casino in Germany, he started playing roulette. And the adrenaline and thrill of winning money was something that stuck with him and something he could never shake. Unfortunately, he, like almost any gambling addict, he would lose his money. And when he lost all of his money, he pawned his possessions, he pawned his coat, he pawned his ring, and he would use that money and lose that as well. So he was always on the brink of financial ruin. And it was really when he was most down and out that he pulled himself together and said to himself, the only way I can survive is by writing my way out of it. And so he began Crime and Punishment, effectively a prisoner in a hotel. He was in Wiesbaden, Germany. It was 1865. He lost all of his money while gambling. He couldn't pay his hotel bill. The proprietor realized this. They stopped giving him his meals. They stopped replacing the candles in his room. They were threatening to call the police on him. He could have been arrested. He didn't have any money left, and so he decided, all right, I'm going to start writing this story, and I'm going to try to get an advance for it, get the money to pay this hotel bill and get me back to Russia. And that's how Crime and Punishment began. It effectively began out of necessity because he wrote with his back against the wall. And that sense of urgency was inspiring for him. It effectively turned literature into a mode of salvation for him, where, you know, he had nothing left to lose. And the only way to save himself and his family was to earn money through his pen.
It's been a long time since I read Crime and Punishment. I was actually the same age as Raskolnikov. And so it's a great way to really get into, thinking about it. Which for listeners, well, you can give a very brief synopsis. But when I read it, it's about a man who commits a murder and he thinks he's morally justified in doing so. I didn't know about the history of it. I just assumed that Dostoevsky was taking the sort of Enlightenment philosopher thought experiment that, well, morals aren't grounded in anything supernatural. So really, we make our own morality. And I just guessed that Dostoevsky took that idea and thought, okay, I'm going to do a reductio ad absurdum and take someone who truly believes this and acts on it, but then his whole life falls apart and he's consumed by guilt and showing the falsity of it. But he is not doing a thought experiment. He's actually basing it on a real person. So briefly, could you sketch out the plot of Crime and Punishment? Not very easy in a short amount of time.
Yeah, you did a good job starting with it. And I think, you know, the way you're reading it is the way that most people read it. I think there's another layer beneath it. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. Basically, it's a murder story told from the murderer's perspective. And Raskolnikov, the murderer, decides that he's justified in killing a pawnbroker because pawnbrokers are, when you think about it, they are capitalizing on the misery of impoverished people. A pawnbroker is making money on interest on the backs of people who can least afford to pay this additional money. So both Dostoevsky and Raskolnikov see pawnbrokers as preying on the weak. So Raskolnikov thinks, what if I kill a pawnbroker, take her money, and use that money for benevolent purposes? Wouldn't I be justified in committing this crime? What lies beneath all this is the story of Pierre-François Lacenaire, who is a French murderer whose trial took place in 1835. Now, Lacenaire was different from the way people generally imagined murderers at the time. Most people thought of them as being uneducated and from the lower classes, but Lacenaire was intelligent, he was debonair, he was attractive, he was eloquent, he was well-educated, he came from a petit bourgeois family, a family that was quite wealthy but lost its wealth just before he came of age. So he had a chip on his shoulder and he resented fate for the hand that it dealt him. He decides to, he's involved in a double murder. The murder weapons are an axe and a sharpened file. And he wanted to use that money to perpetrate yet another crime, which was effectively to rob banks. And the way he would rob banks is to actually rob their collection clerks. So he would lure a collection clerk up to a furnished apartment that he would pay for, and that he would pay rent for, he would pay the furniture for. And when the collection clerk arrived, he would kill the collection clerk and take whatever money he had in his satchel. When word got out about Lacenaire's crimes, the fact that he was caught, and his trial, It became an immediate sensation in Paris. Crowds went to see the trial take place. They wanted to see Lacenaire. There was a cult of personality that grew up around Lacenaire that was baffling for Dostoevsky to see and remarkable. Now, part of the reason why that cult took place is not only because he was handsome and eloquent, but because he started writing his memoirs as quickly as he could in the few weeks between his trial and his execution by guillotine. And in those memoirs, he insisted that the reason why he committed these crimes is so that he could exact revenge upon an unjust society. Right? He said in his memoirs, you know, "I preach the religion of fear to the rich because the religion of love has no power over their hearts." When people read the memoirs, they were captivated by it, and there was an incredible allure to it. Dostoevsky is reading about the entire case a couple decades later. And so what he's reacting to is not only the crimes themselves, but the cult surrounding it. And what Dostoevsky saw was that here was someone who claimed to have a philosophy, who claimed to be doing something for altruistic purposes. But really what's happening is that beneath all of that is he's killing people for nothing. But there's no higher purpose whatsoever. And this dynamic is what Dostoevsky imports into Crime and Punishment and what he uses to create Raskolnikov. So if you read Crime and Punishment and you finish that book and you think that Raskolnikov kills for philosophical purposes, that's because Raskolnikov has eluded being captured by you, the reader. Because beneath all of it, there aren't any philosophical purposes. The reason why he does it, there's a small moment where he is confessing what he's done to Sonia, his love interest. And he said that what he really wants is to take everything by the tail and to whisk it off to the devil. He has an impulse just to destroy, and that includes destroying himself. And this perverse influence at destruction for its own sake is the sort of thing that Dostoevsky loved to explore over and over again.
I want to dive into how Dostoevsky takes the story of Lacenaire and then shifts it in a story. But one question first about the Lacenaire trial itself. You mentioned that it scandalized and shocked France, and it sounds like there's something different about this trial than what happened before. And using murder for the sake of one's personal gain, I mean, that's a long story. You can have Borgia popes. I mean, really, the entire, you know, story of human history. But is there something different about it that Lacenaire doesn't try to hide it, or he openly tries to justify it? What element do you think really shocks people here?
I think, well, part of what was shocking is the cavalier attitude that he had towards the crimes that he committed, right? He once said while he was in prison to his interviewers, you know, "I kill a man as I drink a glass of wine." Now, whether or not he was joking or partially joking, there was something that seemed to be chilling about that, that he did it without any remorse at all. And again, I don't think it's just the fact that he seems like what we would today call a sociopath. It's that the sociopath ends up having a band of supporters, of people who will read his every word, people who will devour the poetry that he was writing. That was the thing that disturbed Dostoevsky the most. And what he saw when he looked at that was this emblem of what could destroy Western civilization. We talked earlier about Russia being like on the brink or on the edge of Europe, where it's trying to decide if it's going to follow Europe or not follow Europe. Here was a warning for Dostoevsky, and what Dostoevsky took as a warning for all of Russia, that there was something awry with Western civilization, and the Lacenaire case was an example of what was potentially wrong with it. And if we were to follow the bourgeois example, this is where we would end up. We, meaning the Russians, the Russian Empire. And so, you know, he's trying to enter into this debate about the direction in which Russian culture should go, Russian, you know, society. And it was, you know, a difficult book for him to write. The responses to it were incredibly divided. Some people loved it, some people hated it. Some people thought that he was trying to demean and debase anyone who wanted to make a difference in Russian society, and other people saw it for what it was, which was, you know, an attempt to take a middle path of Dostoevsky himself, you know, was a radical when he was younger. That's why he was imprisoned. And he was sympathetic to the radicals. And he wanted to show a radical, this, in this case, it's Dostoevsky, it's Raskolnikov. He wanted to show how someone who has good intentions could end up going down a dark path. You know, we think of good and evil as being diametrically opposed, but in the Dostoevskian universe, they are really two doubles that walk side by side down the foggy Petersburg streets.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Right, and the point you make is that Raskolnikov starts to merge with Dostoevsky as he gets into the story of Lacenaire. And anyone who's written before, whether they're writing fiction or nonfiction, you spend enough time with someone who's dead or imaginary, and they almost become a real distinct person in your mind. Some have called this, Napoleon Hill, the Cabinet of Invisible Counselors, that you could imagine having a conversation with somebody, and it can be good who they are, or you inhabit it so much that it starts to take over and become destructive. Yeah. So what is this like for Dostoevsky as he's working very hard to flesh out Raskolnikov, tell things from his perspective? And it's very hard in a book when you have a protagonist to not sympathize with them, even if it's someone that you shouldn't, or a Walter White in Breaking Bad, maybe a more contemporary example.
Yeah. So you're touching upon something I think is important about Dostoevsky's fiction in general, which is that it's incredibly autobiographical. A lot of the circumstances are taken from Dostoevsky's life. A lot of the impulses and ideas are impulses and ideas that Dostoevsky himself entertained and that he saw in himself. So in a way, it's not an incredible act of imagination to think about what a man like Raskolnikov would have thought. What it really is, it's an act of honesty and an act of self-awareness to put into a novel things that he himself was already thinking and what he had already imagined over and over again. So, you know, when he went to Siberia, he was surrounded by murderers, surrounded by people who had actually committed crimes like this. And before he went to Siberia, murder was just something that was a faraway thing. It was something abstract. It was not something that he had really, you know, felt in his life very directly. And so if he wrote about it, it was also something gothic or something, you know, phantasmagoric. But with the murderers in Siberia, he was listening to real tales about why they did it, how they felt when they were doing it. And Dostoevsky was captivated. He kept seeking out these stories. He had this morbid imagination. He wanted to feel what it was like. And he was feeling it from the other side as well. So he, you know, faced a firing squad or was next in line for a firing squad just before he was sent to Siberia. He thought he was going to die. He thought that he was going to be executed by the Tsar's men. And so he knew what it felt like to be the victim of murder or of killing. And exploring both of these sides, being able to see very clearly what it's like to be on both sides of this awful equation was part of what made Crime and Punishment such a compelling read for people at the time. You know, when it was first coming out, it was serialized in a magazine, and there were reports that people were feeling viscerally ill when they were reading it, that they had never encountered a tale that included such a graphic description of a murder before, because it wasn't something that you were really allowed to do.
Right. Arguably, I think, at least today, the interest in true crime, whether book or podcast, is that some people like the feeling of being a co-conspirator without actually having to, you know, commit actual crimes. But how was that received when this book was published? Because the idea of forensic and criminal psychology is something that evolves over time, because which can coincide with understanding of what mental illness is as well. So this is at this time period, pre-Freudian and all that. Mm-hmm. So what did it mean at this time when the book is published to sympathize with a murderer based on how people understood the mindset of murderers?
Well, one of the things that was appalling, at least among the liberals at the time, was they thought that this was Dostoevsky effectively labeling all progressive thinkers as murderers, as people who wanted to kill, which is not what Dostoevsky wanted to do. He did, as you said earlier, want to take an idea to its extreme in order to show the problems of it. But our opinions about Raskolnikov should be complex. They shouldn't be pat. They shouldn't be simple. So it was difficult for people to grapple with exactly how to understand Raskolnikov. And that's part of what made the book so compelling, that you know, Dostoevsky was weighing in on a large debate about what it meant to be a good person and what it meant to change society. And there were no easy answers. You know, at the end, Raskolnikov is shipped off to Siberia the same way that Dostoevsky was shipped off to Siberia. And what's partly disturbing about the end of Crime and Punishment is that even at the end, even after Raskolnikov submits himself to the police, he's not actually sorry for what he's done. He doesn't feel any remorse for the two women that he's killed. If you read carefully, you realize he keeps forgetting that Lizaveta, the pawnbroker's sister, has been killed at all. And, you know, for your listeners who have read Crime and Punishment, a lot of the readings of Crime and Punishment, most people come away thinking that, oh, in the end of Crime and Punishment, it's sort of a cop-out because he finds God and everything is good in the end and it's this happy ending. That's just not the way to read it at all. He has a copy of the Bible. It's the only book you are allowed legally to read if you are a Siberian prisoner. And he has it under his pillow, but he never opens it. And when the novel closes, we're still sort of on this precipice, not knowing if he's going to open that book or not. He's still not fully remorseful for what he's done. He's falling in love with a woman named Sonia who's followed him out to Siberia, but the love itself has undercurrents of resentment. And that ambiguity was very difficult to grapple with, and it didn't map neatly onto the binary that was going on in Russian society at the time. You were either a Slavophile or you were a Westerner. You were either someone who wanted to change society for the better in a certain way, or you wanted to fall back upon a traditional life. And Dostoevsky was trying to chart a different path, and it was very difficult for him to do that.
That's always interesting, because as traditionalist the moral universe of Dostoevsky is in his books, his characters have all sorts of different shades of gray. Speaking of Sonia, this character who's kind of the moral guiding light in this book, she sounds very similar to the stenographer you mentioned in the book, but I'm assuming Sonia was already sketched out before she comes along. So can you describe her and how she enters into the story and everything there?
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Yeah, so we mentioned earlier that, you know, Dostoevsky was addicted to gambling. And the gambling addiction that he suffered from forced him to sign more and more exploitative contracts. And one of the contracts that he signed was effectively, it stipulated that he had to write a novel by November 1st, 1866. And if he didn't finish that novel in time, he would cede the royalties to all of his works for the next 9 years, which basically would have ended his career. He wouldn't have been able to make ends meet if that would have happened. Unfortunately, 1866 is also when Crime and Punishment is coming out and it's being serialized. So he's spending the entire year focusing on Crime and Punishment, which was a huge hit. By October 1st, 1866, 1 month before the deadline, he still hadn't written a single page of this novel that he was required to write. So he asks his friends, what am I supposed to do? I haven't written anything. And one of his friends says, I've got an idea. I'll write one chapter. We'll get our other friends to write different chapters. And you just submit it that way. And Dostoevsky says, no, I can't do that. I can't sign my name to writing that I haven't written myself. So then the friend says, all right, well, I've got another idea. Why don't you dictate the novel to a stenographer and you can write it faster that way? That was an acceptable solution. So Dostoevsky hired a stenographer. She was a young woman. Her name was Anna. She came to his door shortly after October 1st of 1866. They spent the rest of the month with him dictating to her, The Gambler, and he submitted in time. And over the course of that month, he started falling in love with her and said, look, I have to write the rest of Crime and Punishment with you as well. And he did. And a few weeks after Crime and Punishment was finished, they got married. And she was really the first genuine love of his life, the mother of his children, the only real stabilizing force that he had in his life. And it changed him forever. Now, Sonia, as you mentioned, already existed in, you know, the earlier sections of Crime and Punishment that were written. But it's almost as if Dostoevsky had conjured Anna into existence by writing about Sonia, because Sonia effectively saves Raskolnikov in a way that Anna tries to save, anyway, Dostoevsky. And it's through this act of love that the isolated, lonely Raskolnikov comes back into society, or is potentially coming back into society. And it's that relationship that Dostoevsky felt redeemed him as well.
Having written a book, I'm terrified by the thought of that. You have a huge thing that's due in a month and you haven't started. So, wow. I'm a little bit rusty, but I think I remember reading on a commentary on Crime and Punishment that there are a number of secondary plot details that don't match up. So you can see some of the duct tape and patch and chicken wire that's holding together the story. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of commentary about how, you know, Dostoevsky seems to be rushed. He sort of rushed his writing a little bit, and he had to rush because he didn't have any time. And it was a constant source of frustration for him. You know, he referred to himself as a proletarian writer. You know, I am a proletarian writer, whereas, you know, if I were someone like Turgenev or Tolstoy, I would have the time to sit back and write very carefully because I won't need to meet a deadline because I don't need the money. He felt that he always had to shortchange his own ideas because of his pressing material needs. And while that's true, at the same time, those pressing needs also inspired him. Like, there's something about just having your back against the wall, having 1 month to write a novel, that really got his creativity flowing. And the stress of it was in a way its own inspiration.
Well, that's a very interesting point, just kind of as an aside, that artistic achievement doesn't directly correlate with how much time is invested. It can with some people, of course, but then others like Dostoevsky or Isaac Asimov, who wrote something on the order of 500 books in his lifetime, which is about a book every 2 weeks. Some are stinkers, some are mediocre, some are enduring classics that they're still making television series about today, like The Foundation. So when you're working at that volume, I mean, you can't help but have a few hits. So I don't know if that's a lesson there. So to tie in your book by getting into the history of it, Crime and Punishment will forever be, I mean, an enduring classic of literature. And you argue, and I would agree with it, that it changed the world in many ways. So what does this tell us, getting into the history, getting into the characters and what happened personally with Dostoevsky? What does that say about the legacy of Crime and Punishment? And why do you think Crime and Punishment has been such an enduring book?
Well, there are a lot of potential answers to that. I think I'll offer, you know, one in particular. I think Crime and Punishment is partly about the allure of destruction and the allure of self-destruction. And we aren't supposed to think about destruction and self-destruction as being fundamental human traits. I think the standard, you know, Enlightenment rationalist understanding of what it means to be human is that you are a pleasure-maximizing creature. You are a singular person. You have clear intentions. You try to do things logically. You maybe don't always do things logically, but you are trying to be a better person and you know who you are. For Dostoevsky, all these things are false. If you think you know who you are fooling yourself. You are an assembly of contradictory impulses. You work against your thoughts. You are of two or more minds about any given thing at the same time or at different times. You are hidden from yourself. You are a mystery to yourself. You will act to spite yourself. You will do things that are not in your own best interest. And you will potentially destroy yourself, or you will destroy the people around you. It's these irrational elements of what it means to be human, these perverse elements that captivated Dostoevsky. And he was writing at a time when rationality and science and the scientific method was really driving how people were trying to understand how human history can unfold and how society can develop. there was this notion that we can get better and better, that we are driving towards a more and more ideal civilization. And Dostoevsky didn't believe in any of that. He didn't think that we were suddenly going to make it to paradise, or even slowly make it to paradise. He thought that there was something self-destructive embedded within individuals and within society as a whole. And his novels show that in a way that other novels really didn't at the time. And it was speaking to something that people weren't really talking about. And that's partly why they are still with us today.
Well, as research has borne out over the century plus since he wrote his book, I think he's been very much vindicated about all of our cognitive biases, how we can fool ourselves into different things. And our decision-making is many things, but very often it is not rational whatsoever.
Right.
Well, I mean, this is a really great, I mean, background into this. And it's a story, I mean, not just on Crime and Punishment, but also the culture that produced it and understanding all the nuances. So there's much more to it, of course. And for listeners who want to check out the book, the name is The Sinner and the Saint, Dostoevsky and the Gentleman Murderer Who Inspired a Masterpiece. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
All right, that is all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes for this and all my other episodes and include sources, maps, or other relevant information, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Parthenon is the name of the podcast network that History Unplugged is a part of, along with other great history shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. This really helps the show grow. The second thing is to join our membership program on Patreon. And if you do so, you can get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of the show, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening and see you next time.